which the wrong people evidently possessed, wouldn't need to resort to standard private investigator techniques, shadowing her the same way that a PI would conduct surveillance of a wife suspected of adultery. There was only one means by which to identify the follower in the sedan, but Bibi hesitated to plunge into a confrontation. She was grateful to Paxton for encouraging her to get a firearm and teaching her how to use it. But the difficult truth was that acquiring a gun, with expert knowledge of its function, wasn't adequate preparation for pointing it at another person and squeezing the trigger. For 5 minutes, she drove a random route, brooding about options. The tail fell back and moved closer and fell back again, even allowing another car to come between them and provide him with cover, but he didn't fade away as she hoped he might. At last, she became sufficiently agitated to force the issue. She drove to Pacific Coast Highway, to an area that boasted a wealth of trendy restaurants and night spots, ensuring a flood of traffic and enough witnesses to make her feel safe. She timed her approach to an intersection and stopped first in line as the controlling light turned red. The stalker on wheels was two vehicles behind her, mostly blocked from view by a Cadillac Escalade. She put the Explorer in park, set the brake, and got out. As she strode past the Escalade, which sparkled with a surfeit of aftermarket gewgaws, the man behind the wheel flashed her a scowl and a what-the-hell gesture, powering down his window to say gratuitously, "You don't own the road, bitch!" In a mood, she drew one finger across her throat, as if threatening to slash his, and left him to worry that he had insulted a violent lunatic. The stalker slouched in a black Lexus. Even through a windshield half-cataracted by reflections from a street lamp, the identity of the driver was as apparent as it was surprising. Chubb Coy, the head of hospital security, who had all but accused Bibi of lying about the middle-of-the-night visit by the man with the therapy dog. Chubb Coy sat like a humorless Mr. Toad behind the wheel of the Lexus, his old cop intuition no doubt itching like poison ivy. The moment he saw Bibi coming, Coy wheeled the Lexus to his left, nearly clipping her with the front bumper, and crossed the double yellow lines into the southbound lanes. To a chorus of car horns and shrieking brakes, he completed a 180-degree turn and accelerated into the night. Chapter 45. No Haven from Her Enemies. Bibi Blair trembled violently when she got behind the wheel of the Explorer and pulled shut the driver's door. The cause of her shakes wasn't primarily fear, although fear was part of it. Anger. Yes, all right. Coy's offensive invasion of her privacy angered her. But she was smoldering, not hot. The principal cause of her distress was indignation, shock, and displeasure at the intrusion of massive unreason into the workings of the world. Resentment at the sudden tangle of narrative lines in her life, which she had spent so many years crafting into a tight and comfortable linear story. The whole Calida business made no sense. Opening a door to somewhere else, to a cold and smelly rotten flower elsewhere in which dwelt hostile and inhuman powers. The hoodie-wearing Good Samaritan and therapy dog who were visible to some cameras but not to others. Now Chubb Coy and his itchy intuition, trailing her through the night. Far beyond the limits of his authority, which extended only as far as the hospital grounds. In retrospect, she was pretty sure it had been Coy's voice on the phone asking about top agent. He had come into her life before Calida Butterfly, before the divination session that supposedly had invited the supernatural upon her, before Bibi had even heard about the wrong people. And yet common sense insisted that each weirdness was linked to the others. The driver of the Escalade behind her pressed hard on his horn the instant the light changed, having gotten in touch once more with his essential rudeness, now that Bibi turned out not to be a violent psychopath. A few minutes later, on a residential street lined with massive old sycamores gone leafless at winter's end, she parked at the curb to think. She turned off the headlights, but not the engine, because she felt safer if she remained able to rock it away from the curb at an instant's notice. Think. Since everything had gone screwy in her apartment, she had been reacting with animal emotion to events, instead of with her usual calm and consideration. She had been playing by their rules, the silly putty rules of crazy people. Now she realized that by doing so, she had contributed to the momentum of the insanity. Think. The unreal and flat-out seemingly impossible things that had happened would have logical explanations if she thought about them enough. And the threats that seemed to be rising all around her would then either diminish or even evaporate altogether. Think. Her phone rang. The caller ID indicated that Bibi was phoning herself. So they were mocking her. Clever bastards. Whatever else the wrong people might be, they were apparently techno wizards. She answered with minimal commitment. Yeah? A man with a silken, subtly seductive voice said, "Hello, Bibi. Have you found Ashley Bell yet?" She told herself that by participating in a conversation, she would be playing by their rules. But if she terminated the call, she stood no chance of learning anything useful. She said, "Who is this?"
"My surname at birth was Faulkner."
From that peculiar reply, Bibi inferred that obfuscation and evasion would define his style, but she played along. "Any relation to the writer?"
"I'm delighted to say no. I hate most books and bookish people, so I changed my name. I am now, and have been for a long time, known as Birkenau Terezin."
He spelled it for her.
"Friends call me Burke."
She doubted that such a name appeared in any Orange County phone book, on the voter rolls, or in the property tax records. "What can I do for you, Mr. Terezin?"
"I'm standing now in your apartment."
She didn't take the bait.
"If I may say so,"
Terezin continued,
"you have taste, but lack the means to afford fine things. The result is an earnest but tacky attempt at interior design. Your parents have resources. Why didn't you reach into their pockets?"
"Their money is theirs. I'll make my own."
"Maybe you will. Maybe you won't. We've found the 248 pages of the novel you're currently writing, which we're taking, along with your computer. We will destroy both."
Bibi glanced at the laptop lying on the passenger seat. The 248 pages were duplicated in its memory.
"We'll also get the laptop,"
Terezin said. Bibi wouldn't give him the satisfaction of reacting to that lame attempt to make her think he could read her mind.
"And if you should copy the pages onto a flash drive, we'll get that as well. And smash it."
On the sidewalk, a man approached through pools of lamplight and lakes of sycamore darkness. He was walking a German shepherd. To her caller, Bibi said, "What do you want from me?"
"Only to kill you."
Man and dog passed the explorer. She watched them recede in the passenger side mirror. Terezin continued,
"I'd rather it wasn't something as common as a bullet to the head. Too banal for a writer whose short stories have appeared in such esteemed magazines. Death by 1,000 stab wounds would be nice, especially if we used 1,000 sharpened pencils and left you bristling like a porcupine."
The response that occurred to her was straight out of a low-rent TV drama, so she remained mute.
"We believe in justice, Bibi. Don't you think all living things deserve justice?"
"You do," she said.
"Cancer cells are alive, Bibi. Did you ever stop to think about that? They are so enthusiastic about life. They grow far faster than normal cells. A tumor is a living thing. It deserves justice." I haven't done anything to you, she said, being careful not to whine and thereby suggest weakness.
You offended me. You deeply offended us when you allowed your ignorant masseuse to demand answers. Why was Bibi Blair spared from cancer?
The answer is simple as this. So that she could die another way. Bibi had no hope that conversing reasonably with a homicidal fanatic would convert him to clear thinking, and there was a chance that she would stroke the fires of his madness and make him more dangerous than he already was. Neither could she survive by hanging up on him and pretending that he didn't exist. She went to the quick of it and said, "Who is Ashley Bell?" The worm of condescension turning in his voice was almost as loud as his words.
You aren't taking this pathetic quest seriously, are you?
Why do you care if I am or I'm not? Rather than answer her, Terezin said,
To us, you're just a worm, a pissant, something we step on without noticing. You don't have a hope of finding her. We'll find you first and put an end to this. Did you know, lovely Bibi, that every smartphone is also a GPS? Everywhere you go, the traitorous phone reports your whereabouts in real time.
She knew this, of course, but never imagined that she might be quarry.
Anyone who has the right connections with the police or with certain tech companies can find you at any moment of any day. And anyone with the ability to hack their systems can find you too, my lovely pissant.
The phone felt alive in her hand.
And your 3-year-old Ford Explorer,
Terezin said,
bought without your parents' money, a proud statement of your independence. Of course, it has a GPS. You can be followed by satellite anywhere you go. And by the way, if you go to Mom and Dad for help, we'll kill them too.
She switched off the phone and dropped it on the floor, but she knew that wasn't good enough. Its perpetual signal would still locate her. Although she killed the engine of the SUV, that wouldn't be good enough either. She zippered open her purse, crammed into it the slim book with Panther and Gazelle, zippered it shut, and grabbed her laptop, and with it, the sole remaining 248 pages of her unfinished novel. She threw open the door and got out of the Explorer. By abandoning the phone and the Ford, she would be conceding a possibility to the impossible. If she believed that the wrong people could find her by such traditional means as high technology, it seemed she also had to accept that when Kalida held a divination session, these same people were alerted to the practice by the psychic equivalent of seismic waves that they could follow back to the source. Headlights appeared 3 blocks to the west, ice white and flaring strangely through the sentinel sycamores, as if this were the witchy light emanating from an extraterrestrial craft, stretching the bare limb shadows until they broke. When Bibi pivoted at the sound of an engine, she encountered more headlights 2 blocks to the east, as an immense SUV rounded the corner with the menace of a vehicle packed full of CIA assassins. The moment seemed too genre movie to be taken seriously, but many of the least credible movie villains of the past few decades had in recent years manifested in the real world, as over the top as any sociopath portrayed by any scenery-chewing actor. To run west or east might be to flee into the jaws of a pincer, and to go north would require dashing across the street in full view. Left with no viable alternative, after the briefest hesitation, Bibi accepted the fact of this new dark and unfathomed world in which she found herself. She ran across the sidewalk, onto the front lawn of a shingle-sided house with dormered roof, white trim, deep front porch, and windows glimmering like the panes of a candled lantern. This was a place where you took refuge after a long and dispiriting day, where you could always go home again. But it was no home to her, and she suspected that if she attempted to take refuge there, her knock would bring to the door Chub Coy, or the once-named Faulkner, now known as Birkenau Terezin,
or someone more surprising and even more hostile. She raced alongside the residents, through the outfall of light from the windows, into the black night of the backyard. No destination yet in mind, driven by an instinct that promised safety only in perpetual motion. Part 3. From time to time, the world goes mad. Chapter 46. Where she went when she couldn't go home again. Phone discarded, vehicle abandoned, clinging to the laptop not for its inherent value or its function, but for the 248 pages that existed nowhere except in its memory, Bebe Blair entered the backyard of the shingled house, wondering if she might be running from a twisted equivalent of the police detective in Les Miserables, or from a variant of the robot assassin in The Terminator, as if it mattered a damn whether her ordeal conformed to classic fiction or to pop art. From the street came the bark of brakes, but no crash. Either an accident had been averted, or two vehicles were disgorging pursuers. The property was encircled by one of those stucco-coated concrete block privacy walls that Californians called a fence. At the rear of the lot, Bebe put her purse and computer on top of the fence. She got a two-hand grip on the bricks that capped the stuccoed blocks and climbed into another backyard. Having retrieved laptop and purse, she set out past a swimming pool dimly revealed by the quarter moon, circulation pump rumbling. In the passage between the dark residence and the property fence, a bicycle with a front-mounted cargo basket leaned against the house. Bebe put the laptop and purse in the basket and wheeled the bike into the street. She boarded it and pedaled westward, adding theft to the crime of trespass. Glancing back, she saw no one, and dared to believe that they wouldn't discover she had nabbed the bicycle. If bad men actually were pursuing her on foot, and if they returned to their SUVs to conduct a wider search, she would be dead when they caught her on the street. Their type wouldn't be afraid to risk a four-wheel drive execution in public. Right away, she needed to get down from the hills and out of sight over the Balboa Peninsula Bridge, so they wouldn't know which way she'd gone. When she reached Newport Boulevard, she swung left past the hospital, leaning hard into the turn to shorten the arc and maintain speed. Out of the turn, onto a straightaway. All downhill from there to the peninsula. Three lanes. Little traffic at the moment. If there was a bike lane, she had no interest, preferring the wide, clear pavement. Stones and sticks and junk ended up in the bike lane, all kinds of crap that, at high speed, could send you wobble-wheeled into an embankment or jack your ride out from under you. Leaning forward, head low, slicing through the cool night air. Going faster than she had ever ridden a bicycle before. Passing some of the cars and trucks, all of the drivers staying wide of her when they realized that she was among them. She would have been exhilarated if she hadn't been expecting the wrong people to ram her from behind. She was anxious about encountering the police, too. A bicycle didn't belong in the center of the boulevard. She wasn't wearing a helmet, as the law required. And she was carrying a concealed weapon. She had a permit for it, but if there was a misunderstanding... Before she quite realized it, the harbor glimmered to her left, and she was crossing the bridge. She raced down the final slope to the flats of the peninsula. Here, land was in such short supply and so valuable, the seriously wealthy and the merely well-to-do lived in fabulous waterfront houses on postage-stamp properties, within shouting distance of older, funky beach cottages rented by groups of surf rats working short-hour, low-wage zombie jobs to preserve most of their time for tearing up epic waves or wiping out. Either way, because all that mattered was being there. Tentacled fog felt its way slowly, blindly off the sea and through the streets, breathing a cold dew on Bebe's face. She left the bicycle in an alley behind a block of businesses, closed at that hour, and continued on foot to the nearer of two piers. As Thursday waned, traffic was light. For a place of such tight-packed structures and dense population, Balboa Peninsula felt lonely just then. It was easy to believe that an unaccompanied woman might vanish between one block and the next, never to be seen again. As the fog married the land to the sea, passing traffic made Bibi think of submersibles plying the ocean through a sunken city, though one with humbler architecture than Atlantis. By the time she reached the vicinity of the pier, where faux antique iron lamps silvered the mist, she seemed to be the only person in sight. For emergencies, she had a key to pet the cat. Just inside the front door, during the alarm system's 1 minute delay, she entered the code with the keypad. Spaced throughout to inconvenience thieves, security lamps provided more than enough light for Bibi to reach the stairs in the back left corner of the shop. The store occupied 2 commercial units. Her dad also leased the rooms above, which otherwise would have been rented as an apartment. He used half that upper space to store merchandise, and the other half served as his office, complete with a kitchenette and a cramped bathroom with shower. In addition to a desk and filing cabinets, the office contained a comfortable sofa and 2 armchairs. On the walls hung 5 framed mint posters for The Endless Summer. Her dad wouldn't sell even one. After turning on a desk lamp, Bibi closed the louvered shutters, which were tight enough to allow only a little light to escape. When she sat in the office chair where her father had sat, she felt safe for the first time since she'd fled her apartment. Beside the desk lamp stood a framed photograph of Bibi and her mother. She so wanted to call them. But she remembered Terezin's threat. If she went to her parents for help, he would kill them too. She wondered what the police would say if she approached them with her bizarre story. Would they invoke the danger to herself and others law and remand her for a psychiatric evaluation? For the moment, at least, the usual authorities were of no use to her. She opened her laptop and plugged it in. On the desk stood a mug holding a selection of pens and pencils. She opened a desk drawer in search of a tablet or notepad. Among the items in the drawer was a silver bowl containing a 1-zip plastic bag full of Scrabble tiles. She stared at it for a while before she picked it up. The online phone directory for Orange County included numerous people named Belle, but Bibi couldn't find an Ashley. There might be a spouse or daughter named Ashley not included in the listing, but to find her would require calling every number or visiting every address where one was provided. And there were surely other Bells who had unlisted numbers. The task was too daunting. She needed to think of a smarter, quicker way to conduct the search. She Googled Ashley Bell and found a number of them in states from Washington to Florida, but none in Orange County, which made her doubt her assumption that this person must be a local. She discovered photos of some of the Ashleys on Facebook, males and females, but she experienced no frisson of connection when she studied their faces. During all this, she kept glancing at the bowl full of lettered tiles. It wasn't the same bowl that Kalida had used, and the Amazon's tiles had been in a flannel bag, not a 1-zip. So, questions. If Scrabblemancy was just a lark to Murphy and Nancy, why would he want his own gear? Had an amusement grown into an obsession? But assuming that Kalida wasn't a fraud, that she was a gifted diviner, the gear itself was of no use to people without her power. Did Murphy fancy himself some kind of medium? That seemed absurd. People who made it to 50 by coasting happily along on an it'll be what it'll be mantra, whose relationship with fate was guided by a don't ask, don't tell mentality, who never exhibited a passing interest in philosophical issues, who lived for work and surf and surfers' simple pleasures, didn't abruptly become occultists any more than they became true-believing Jehovah's Witnesses, passing out pamphlets door to door. And if her father had gone over the edge, her mother had gone with him, because in a fundamental way, each had always been the other. Perhaps their foremost saving grace was their commitment to each other, deep and unshakable. If anything, Nancy would be less likely than Murphy to become a seeker of hidden knowledge. She was top agent, hard-nosed flogger of dream homes and fixer-uppers, a surfer babe who insisted on shag-cut hair because it saved her X number of minutes each day that could better be spent on maintaining a tan and catching some waves. Drinker of tequila shots and beer, eater of jalapenos and habaneros, and all but certainly more enthusiastic in her marriage bed than her daughter cared to contemplate. Nancy was far too earthy to be floated off her feet by the helium of occult pursuits. And if not Nancy, then never Murphy. Divination with Scrabble tiles could be no more to them than a party game. After working a while longer with the computer, Bibi took a break to use the bathroom. On the vanity, beside the sink, she found a bottle of alcohol, a packet of seamstress's needles, and a white cotton cloth crusted with old bloodstains and damp with new ones. Chapter 47, Night Visitors. Bibi would make no assumptions about her mom and dad, neither about their interest in the occult nor anything else. She loved them, and she trusted them. The silver bowl, the lettered tiles, and the blood evidence couldn't possibly mean what they seemed to mean. She pushed it all to the back of her mind until some simple explanation asserted itself, which was sure to happen, some sudden understanding that presented an entirely different interpretation of the facts, some answer so blazingly obvious that she would feel stupid for not having grasped it immediately upon finding the items in the bathroom. Exhausted after an eventful day, she got a cold bottle of beer from the office refrigerator and sat in an armchair. Maybe the beer would chill her in the good sense of the word and help her catch a few hours of sleep. Having stopped speculating about Nancy and Murphy, she brooded now about the person whose life she was supposed to save as payment for her cancer going into remission. She repeatedly reviewed what Terezine had said on the phone. His confidence that he would kill Bibi before she got close to Ashley didn't come solely from his assessment of Bibi as an easy target. The logical thing to infer was that he knew Ashley Bell's whereabouts, and therefore he knew how hard it would be for Bibi to find her, which seemed to point to one of two possibilities. First, maybe Ashley Bell was one of them, one of the wrong people, and capable of using paranormal means to remain hidden if she didn't want to be found. Second, and more likely, she was their prisoner, held for the usual wicked reasons, or for some purpose uniquely horrifying. If that proved to be the case, Bibi would have to descend through several levels of their homemade hell to free her. To free her. To save Ashley Bell. At her kitchen table with Kalida, Bibi had insisted that she possessed neither the passion nor the skills to become the comic book rescuer of people she didn't even know. Yet now she contemplated that very task. Something had changed, not necessarily for the better. Perhaps she hadn't gained confidence in her skills, hadn't discovered in herself a greater depth of courage than she had believed existed. Perhaps instead she was finding it easier to attempt unreason than to resist it. She set the empty beer bottle on the small round table beside the armchair and closed her eyes, fatigued to the point at which the mere idea of lifting her arms from the arms of the chair was itself physically tiring. She nevertheless doubted that she would sleep. Her tumbling thoughts had no capacity for exhaustion. From as far back as she could remember, she had been the girl whose mind was always spinning. In sleep, of course, that mental wheel still turned, and it spun forth a thread of dreams. If the tall, robed, and hooded figures appeared in her dreams that night, they were among presences and occurrences that she didn't later remember. The sheet-wrapped corpse that played supporting roles in her occasional nightmares, that clearly wanted to be center stage, sat now in several scenes in different places, prevented by its bound condition from a more active performance. Its immobility was curious, considering that anything should be possible in a dream. The cadaver could have split out of its cocoon at the whim of the dreamer's mind, could have shown its face and wounds as it capered or threatened or strode the stage in a solemn soliloquy. Instead, it appeared in her hospital room as it had been before, in a chair near the window, its shroud colored by a blazing sunset, and it spoke through its fabric mask.
"The forms. The forms. Things unknown."
Or it sat beside her on the wicker sofa, on the bungalow porch, struggling unsuccessfully to press a hand through the cotton sheeting to touch her, whispering,
"Supreme Master,"
and
"Must be truth,"
and
"Nothing, nothing at all."
Or she opened a door and found the wrapped corpse standing at the threshold as it said,
"Forces of nature."
As weary as Bibi was, slumped there in the office armchair, her encounters with the corpse were not fearsome enough to break the hold of sleep. But later, a more harrowing nightmare had its way with her. More harrowing because it was more than just a dream. She is young, not quite six, alone in her bed where night presses at the bungalow windows. The only light is dim and largely confined to that farther corner of the room where a Mickey Mouse nightlight has been plugged into a wall outlet. Bibi is a small child, but not afraid of the dark. She has been as much embarrassed as amused by Mickey glowing over there in his yellow shoes and red pants with his big, silly smile. Her parents bought the little 5-watt lamp a week earlier because they decided that all children needed reassurance in the dark. Well, Bibi is a child, but not a baby. She is so done with being a baby. Stupid Mickey watching over her is like being told she is still a baby and always will be a baby. Some nights, she gets out of bed and unplugs the stupid glowing mouse. She doesn't want to hurt her parents' feelings. They mean well, which is why she hasn't thrown Mickey away or put him in the bathroom where maybe he wouldn't upset her so much. She really, really, really doesn't want him here. Until this night. Now she is grateful that she isn't in total darkness. She lies on her back in bed, the covers pulled up to her chin, listening intently, waiting for the thing to move. From time to time it crawls or creeps or slides or does whatever the heck it does to get around. But then it goes quiet for a while, as if it's thinking what to do next, thinking about what it wants and how to get it. This has been going on for more than an hour. Earlier, before the bad things started to happen, there were the voices and music of the TV turned low in the living room, which had been nice. If there were those sounds now, Bibi would feel much braver than she does. But the house is quiet, so that when the thing decides to start moving again, there is nothing else she can listen to other than the little noises it makes. This wouldn't be so bad if it were a mouse like Mickey, scurrying around, making mouse sounds. Then she would get out of bed and try to win its trust, catch it gently and carry it outside to let it go free. Mouse sounds were cute, and a mouse would be scared, not dangerous, just frightened. This isn't a mouse, however, and she doesn't think it's afraid. She doesn't want to scream or call for help. That is total baby behavior. And if her mom and dad come running, maybe they won't find anything. Then they'll tease her forever and ever. Something is here in the bedroom with her, for sure. But maybe only she can see and hear it. That's how it sometimes is in stories and on TV. And there is another worry. Maybe her parents will see and hear it. And maybe it will hurt them. If it hurts them, that will be Bibi's fault. Instead of screaming, she wishes the thing away. And every time it becomes quiet, she thinks it's gone. But it isn't gone. Aunt Edith, who sometimes visits from Arizona, says if wishes were fishes, no one would go hungry. But Bibi wishes anyway, uselessly, helplessly. In addition to wishing the terrible thing away, she wishes that the captain already lived in the apartment above the garage, so she could run to him and get his help. He won't move in for a long time, until 2 weeks after her 6th birthday. She hasn't met him yet. She doesn't even know the captain exists. But dreams have no respect for the proper order of past, present, and future. As she dreams of the very young Bibi, adult Bibi would love nothing better than to have the captain in her present-day life, as well as in her life on this long-past night of terror in her bungalow room. When next the quiet ends, she hears the thing questing along a wall. The distinctive rattle of the cord from the nightstand lamp suggests that it is finding its way to her. She turns her head to the right, dreading that she will see the thing ascend into view, hardly more than 2 feet from her face. But the lamp cord ceases rattling between wall and nightstand as the thing explores farther. This time, when it falls silent, it is without doubt under her bed. If she wanted to scream now, she couldn't. She breathes, but has no breath to cry out. If she wanted to run, she couldn't. Her heart beats fast and hard. She is vital and acutely alive. It beats fast, then faster, hard, then harder. But it beats her into a strange submission, a kind of paralysis, in which the cardiac lub-dub sounds to her like two words relentlessly repeated. My fault. My fault. My fault. Quiet pools throughout the bungalow bedroom. Quiet is a drowning weight, fathoms of ocean pressing down. A deep stillness heavy with expectation, in which Bibi can almost hear the thing's thoughts, its needing and wanting and feverish scheming. Perhaps its silent progress was a matter of stealth, or maybe the blankets muffled what sounds it made, for she didn't realize that it was in bed with her until, under the covers, it touched her left foot. Bibi erupted from the office armchair, flung to her feet by the touch of the malignant creature in the dream. Wild-eyed, gasping, she looked around, half expecting to see dream and reality become one, and herself no longer alone or safe. She was cold to her bones, and so emotionally wrung out that she felt hollow. The reason for the nightmare's singular effect did not escape her. Of all her dreams, this was the only one that was also a memory. Although she had long forgotten, she remembered now that she had been there for real, in that place and on that night. And the crawling thing she so feared had been there too. Chapter 48, Extraction. Paxton expected a medium-lift helicopter with a two-man crew to extract them. When the monster Sea Dragon clattered down the sky and landed west of the town, no street was wide enough to accommodate its 79-foot diameter rotor, he realized that new orders had modified the mission. He and his guys arrived in the meadow as the last of the three big turboshaft engines died. The rotary wing wheezed to a stop, and the final flush of downdraft threw dust and chaff in their faces. In addition to two pilots and an air crewman, the Hilo carried two demolition specialists, two search and rescue specialists, four Marines to defend the craft when it was on the ground, and a ton of equipment. Marines were always welcome, even if their presence meant that a firefight previously thought unlikely might now be expected. Most concerning was that the Sea Dragon, used primarily for minesweeping operations, was dressed for assault support with a ramp-mounted GAU-21 50-caliber machine gun. Marine Corporal Ned Sivert, with a straightforward manner and an amused contempt for standard-issue politicians, which had been raised into him in Heflin, Alabama, succinctly explained the new situation.
"Some shit-for-brains White House aide, looking for glory, leaked just enough so the local drag-ass military could decide to ride in here and make themselves an incident if they want to bad enough."
"Then we should get out twice as fast," Pax said.
"Yes, sir, you'd think so. But some plainclothes general in the West Wing now wants Al-Ghazali's body. Not just a smidge of DNA and a picture for the scrapbook. Fact is, he wants all seven bodies."
"At the last minute? Why?"
"I never ask why of my betters. They might tell me. and I might see as how I'm working for even bigger fools than I thought.
Among the equipment on the Hilo were two gas-powered portable generators, compressors, hydraulic jacks, and large inflatable bags of tough material that could lift 1,000-pound slabs of concrete rubble.
"We'll be going home in a flying morgue," Pax said.
Gib, whose mother sometimes saw his father's spirit lingering around their property in Georgia, who himself believed in ghosts and hauntings, said,
"No big deal, Pax. Valiant boys like us don't spook easy."
Pax smiled.
"Valiant boys never spook. They do the spooking."
"Won't always be true,"
Gib said.
"But mostly."
Chapter 49. The Man Who Borrowed the Names of Death. Bibi tweaked open one of the slats in a window shutter and stared out at the sidewalk and the pier parking lot, where the fog sparkled like diamond dust in the glow of the street lamps. She stood there until she felt sure that Pet the Cat wasn't under observation, until she stopped trembling. She recalled now. The memory of the crawling intruder in her bedroom had inspired a repetitive nightmare that had tormented her for 8 months, until she was 6 months short of her 7th birthday. Then, for the first time, she used the captain's magical technique for shedding memories so distressing that they poisoned your life. On an index card, with the captain's help, she'd written a description of the events in her room on that bleak night when Mickey Mouse had failed to keep the boogeyman at bay. Not just what it had been, but how and why it had happened. Holding the card in a pair of tongs, repeating the 6 magic words that Captain taught her, she set it afire with a candle flame. When the captain swept up the ashes with his hands and blew them from his hands into the trash compactor, the unwanted memory was blown from her mind. This slate-wiping trick was a childish device, nothing but a wishing away, no more magical than were the paper and the fire. But she had wanted so desperately and intensely for it to work that it had worked for many years. Bibi didn't understand the psychology of repressed memories. Maybe she didn't want to understand, because if she had deceived herself in this fashion, perhaps she wasn't, after all, the bring-it-on-I-can-take-anything girl that she had always believed she was. More than 15 years after burning that memory in the candle flame, and more than 16 years since the creepy encounter had occurred, the extraordinary stress of this strange night had brought the dormant memory back into flower. But it hadn't restored to her all the details of the repressed experience. That long-ago night, she had known what crawled the room and creeped beneath her bed. She had seen it then. But she couldn't see it now in her mind's eye. Maybe sooner than later, the full truth would come back to her. Although if it did, she might wish that it never had. What she could see clearly now was that some extraordinary event in her past must be related to the remission of her cancer and to all that had occurred since Kalida Butterfly had begun to pull Scrabble tiles from that silver bowl. In the dream that was a memory, maybe the crawling thing in her bedroom had in fact been a horror and far beyond ordinary human experience. But perhaps calling it a thing was a way of clouding the truth, an attempt to evade what had actually happened by transforming the threat into a harmless cliché, into the generic monster of all nightmares. She tried to force recollection, to expand the most crucial moments in the dream, but for the time being, no more details could be recovered. By the time her tremors stopped, it was 4:04 a.m. She returned to her father's desk, searched the drawers, found a pack of unused flash drives, and made 2 copies of the 248-page manuscript that was on her laptop. She crawled into the knee hole and, with scotch tape, securely fixed 1 flash drive to the underside of the desktop. She slipped the other one into a pocket of her jeans. She took a shower in the small bathroom adjacent to her father's office, and then put on again the clothes she had been wearing since she'd fled her apartment. Hungry, she searched the refrigerator in the kitchenette,
but found nothing that she wanted to eat except a pint of dark chocolate ice cream with peanut butter swirl. Not a healthy breakfast by any standard. So what? If the supernatural insisted on weaving its web through her life, denying her the solace of pure reason, then to hell with such reasonable things as low-fat diets and exercise regimens. While she ate, she sat at her father's desk, searching the address book on his computer. Violating his privacy disconcerted her, so that more than once she hesitated to continue. But her future was at stake, if not her life. Her embarrassment never matured into shame, and she searched for the four names that were thus far most central to her dilemma. She found a phone number and address for Kalida Butterfly. When she couldn't find an entry for Ashley Bell or Birkenau Terezin or Chub Coy, she was relieved. To have found any of them, especially all of them, would have forced her to question not just the judgment but the reliability of her parents, which would have been painful in the extreme. Online, she Googled Birkenau Terezin. Although she didn't find a man with that name, she found two places with a history of evil. Terezin proved to be a town in the Czech Republic, which 75 years earlier had been called Theresienstadt and had been part of German-occupied Bohemia. The Nazis had ejected the 7,000 residents of Terezin in order to use the town as a Jewish ghetto, where as many as 58,000 were forced to live at one time and where more than 150,000 passed through during the war years. They lived there only temporarily because Terezin was a transport center to which Jews were taken from all over Czechoslovakia and from which they would be conveyed to various death camps as the gas chambers and furnaces could accommodate them. One of the camps to which they were transported by the tens of thousands was Auschwitz-Birkenau. She wondered what kind of man so hated books and bookish people that he would trade the name Faulkner for names that were synonymous with cruelty and death. Halfway through the pint of ice cream, she realized that she had forgotten something when she'd been searching her dad's address book. Bibi returned to it and, with a pang of remorse for suddenly being such a doubting daughter, typed in Faulkner. The directory popped to Kelsey Faulkner, complete with a local address and phone number. Chapter 50, Fog and the Fog of Time. With the desk light turned off, Bibi felt her way to the window and used the tilt rod to open the louvers on one half of the shutter. She stood, staring out at the lamplit fog that still drifted on shore like the ghost of some poisonous sea that had existed billions of years earlier, before the current healthy sea had formed. With no one to turn to, she would have to be her own detective. And she was as certain as she had ever been about anything that she had little time to wrap the case. The wrong people were searching for her, and she sensed that their numbers might be daunting, that they weren't just a cult of a dozen or two dozen deranged individuals, but were more like a battalion or an army. Whether they sought her by ordinary or paranormal means didn't matter. Either way, when they found her, they would kill her. And for reasons she still didn't quite understand. If Bibi was right about Ashley Bell, that she was a prisoner of these people, held for God knew what purpose, then it would be necessary to find them in order to find her. For that detective work, she needed wheels, and she thought she knew where to get them. But she had to wait for a more reasonable hour, at least 7 o'clock, before making the call. Fog could paint mystery on the most mundane scene. Now, when she thought of Pax in some hellhole unknown to her, the mist also painted the night with melancholy. Sorrow was a degree of sadness that she dared not indulge. It would sap her will and strength. As much as she yearned for Pax, she couldn't dwell on him. She thought of another foggy night, when she had been 6 years old, for just 2 weeks, the evening of the day when Captain had moved into the rooms above the garage. He was the only important newcomer in Bibi's life until, 4 years later, Olaf came to live with her. Previously, the apartment had been rented by a 20-something woman, Hadley Rogers, who was busy with a career in art, not as a painter or instructor, but as a dealer or broker or agent, whatever. She hadn't been a meaningful presence in young Bibi's life, seen most often flitting down the stairs to her Corvette in the carport. Miss Rogers seemed puzzled by children, as if she wasn't entirely sure of their origin or purpose. She seemed less substantial than a real person, more like an animated painting of a person. Captain, on the other hand, was obviously real and important. Tall, rugged-looking, with thick white hair. He was attentive and polite to everyone, even children. Bibi had accompanied her mother when the captain had been shown the apartment, and by the end of the tour, she liked him, and knew she would always and forever like him. In spite of his scarred hands and two missing fingers, though his face was weather-beaten and his eyes were as sad as those of a bloodhound, Captain was glamorous. She just knew he had a lot of good stories to tell. That night, after the fog had laid siege to Corona del Mar, Bibi couldn't fall asleep. After a while, she slipped out of bed and went to get a glass of milk. As she approached the kitchen, where her parents were at the table, talking over mugs of coffee and Kahlua, she heard her mother say something that warned her to step to the side of the doorway, be silent, and listen. "I'm thinking it's a mistake. This has a bad vibe." Murphy said,
"Well, I'm not getting any vibe, good or bad. I'm vibeless, babe."
"I'm serious, Murph."
"Yeah, I figured that out an hour ago."
"Who moves into a place with just two suitcases and a duffel bag?"
"They were big suitcases. Anyway, it's a furnished apartment."
"People still have boxes and boxes of personal belongings."
"You're making yourself crazy for no reason."
"What about Bibi?"
"Listen to yourself, babe. He's not a child molester."
"I didn't say that. Don't put words in my mouth. But he's not like Hadley, hardly home. He's going to be up there all the time. He'll be an influence. She was instantly fascinated with him."
"Retirees do tend to be more homebodies than hot young girls climbing the art world ladder."
"You think Hadley is hot?" Nancy asked.
"Not by my standards. Not even lukewarm. But I have a lot of empathy. I can see the world through other guys' eyes."
"You might need to if I poke out your eyes."
"Here you are, threatening your own husband. And you think maybe some worn-out, worn-down geezer with eight fingers is a problem."
Nancy laughed softly. "I just don't want any bad influences in Bibi's life."
"Then we'll have to move to Florida or somewhere. Because right now, your sister Edith is just across the border in Arizona."
Young Bibi had gone back to bed without milk and worried herself to sleep, afraid that the exotic and interesting captain would soon be gone, replaced by another bland and boring Hadley. She needn't have lost sleep. Captain lived above the garage for more than four wonderful years, until that terrible day of blood and death. Now, standing at the window in her father's office, Bibi saw what might have been dawn light refracting through the fog, faintly pinking it. She looked at the radiant dial of her watch. Almost time to call Pogo. Chapter 51, Thunder Crusher. At 7:05, using the phone on her father's desk, Bibi called Pogo. She expected to wake him, but he sounded as sharp as a shark's tooth when he answered on the second ring.
"Tell me."
"I thought you knew it all."
"Hey, Biebs, you never call me."
"Don't mom me, bro." She asked about the surf rats with whom he shared an apartment. "How are Mike and Nate?"
"Still in bed, probably abusing themselves."
"I'm surprised you sound so together at this hour."
"I was gonna catch a few before work," he said, meaning a few waves. "But I wake up and it's like milk soup. You've gotta have a guide dog to surf this. Anyway, you had me scared, Biebs."
"You mean the cancer thing?"
"Sounded too tough even for you."
But here I am, clean and ready to tear it up.
You've always torn it up.
This has nothing to do with cancer. That's totally yesterday. But I need some help, Pogo.
Why else do I exist?
That old Honda of yours, does it have GPS?
Hell, Biebs, it hardly even has brakes.
Could I borrow it?
Sure.
Don't you want to know why?
Why would I need to know why?
I might want it for a few days.
I've got friends with cars. I've got a skateboard. I'm cool.
Listen, this isn't the boss's daughter working you.
Hey, no. You and me grew up together, Biebs. Anyway, I don't think of Murph as my boss.
He's aware of that. I'd appreciate it if you don't say anything to him about this.
Not a word. When you want the car?
The sooner the better. I'm at the store.
I'll be there in like 20 minutes.
You're the real thing, Pogo.
Biebs?
Yeah?
You catch a bad wave or something?
A real thunder crusher, she said.
Maybe you need more help from me than just the car.
If I do, I'll let you know, sweet boy. After she terminated the call, Bibi opened her purse and took from it the book with the panther and gazelle on the cover. There was no title or author's name on the spine either, and no text on the back. When she opened the book and thumbed through it, the pages were blank. Or they appeared to be blank until faint gray lines of cursive script rippled across the paper, flowing as fluidly as water, gone before she could read a word. She paged through it more slowly, and twice again words appeared, shimmering as if seen through a film of purling water, but rinsed away before they could be read. She examined the binding. There was no space for electronics or batteries to be concealed within the spine. It was just a book. But not just. Chapter 52. Going Home with the Dead. With more than 14,000 combined horsepower, the three General Electric engines produced a confidence-building shriek, and the huge rotary wing thumped the air like a heavyweight boxer's fists pounding the crap out of a punching bag. SEALs and Marines and associated Navy men left the ghost town and headed out country in the last 2 hours of light, at an airspeed of 150 knots. As the deck vibrated under them, the seven dead terrorists were restless in their body bags, restless as they had been in life. Good men and women sought calm, peace, time for reflection. Evil people were eternally restive, intractable, always eager for more thrills, which were the same few thrills endlessly repeated, because the evil were unimaginative, acting on feelings rather than reason. Forever agitated, they were unaware that the cause of their fury was the confining narrowness of the worldview they crafted for themselves. Its emptiness. There would never be an end to them, and always a need for men and women willing to resist them at whatever cost. Just before sunset, without incident en route, they touched down on the aircraft carrier, much to Paxton's relief. There would be a debriefing, after which he expected to call Bibi in California, where it was morning. That expectation was deflated 3 minutes after they debarked from the Hilo. Washington wanted all team members to maintain silence with the outside world for at least another 8 hours, for reasons that they did not feel obliged to share. Chapter 53. Walk the Board, Dudette. When headlights tunneled the fog in the parking lot, and the primer gray Honda glided to the curb like a ghost-driven spirit car, Bibi stepped out the front door of Pet the Cat. Because the heater took a long time to warm up, Pogo left the engine running and came around the front of the car to Bibi.
You've got that surf goddess look going more than ever.
Maybe cancer was good for me. She knew that she was pretty enough, but not fall down gorgeous or anything. On the other hand, Pogo made most of the male models in the big fashion magazines look as if they were trying out for roles as orcs in a possible sequel to the Lord of the Rings movies. He seemed oblivious of his physical perfection, even when girls were throwing themselves at him in such numbers and with such insistence that the air became scintillant with the fragrance of estrogen. It sometimes seemed to Bibi that if Pogo's appearance meant anything at all to him, it was largely an embarrassment. But they truly had grown up together, as he had said earlier, and going to bed with him was as unthinkable as going to bed with a brother, if she'd had one. 2 years older than Pogo, Bibi had taught him how to take the drop, how to slide down the face of a wave immediately after catching it, how to pull a rollover to get through whitewater, how to perform a roundhouse cutback, and other moves, when he was a pre-adolescent surf mongrel, before he surpassed her skill level. His good looks might have mattered to her when she was a preteen and early teenager. Then it had been a power trip to have the full attention of the boy that all the other girls most wanted. But now, and for some years, what she loved about Pogo was his spirit, his humility, his tender heart. He kissed her on the cheek and looked her in the eyes and said, "Who are you hiding out from?" That's not the way it is. In a staring contest, neither one of them would ever be the first to look away. Pogo decided not to make it a contest. He surveyed the lonely, mist-soaked morning as the distant foghorn sounded at the mouth of Newport Harbor. "Just so you